Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Isaiah chapter 24, which I will call an oracle concerning everybody. Now, we have previously considered several oracles concerning the nations surrounding Israel, Moab in chapters 15 and 16, Damascus, Syria in chapter 17, Ethiopia in chapter 18, Egypt in chapter 19 and 20, Babylon in chapter 21, Jerusalem in chapter 22, Tyre and Sidon in the last chapter, chapter 23, and now we're just going to see hellfire and damnation come on everybody. Now, who that everybody is a question. Is it everybody on the earth, or is it everybody surrounding Israel in the ancient known world of the ancient Near East? It depends on how you translate one Hebrew word, Eretz. So we start now in Isaiah 24, verse 1. See, Isaiah says, the Lord is going to lay waste the earth. This is the NIV translation. The Lord is going to lay waste the earth. The Hebrew word translated earth there is Eretz. It could just as well be translated land. See, the Lord is going to lay waste the earth or the land and devastate it. He will ruin its face and scatter its inhabitants. So this oracle is either a prophecy concerning judgment on the whole planet, or maybe on the whole known world at the time, the ancient Near East, or maybe on the land of Israel. Well, whoever Yahweh is going to devastate, he's going to devastate it. He's going to lay it waste. He will ruin its face and scatter its inhabitants. Now, let's look at this translation issue. Gill, Clark, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown all say that many scholars translate Eretz there instead of earth as land, as in the land of Judah. Now, here's some translations that have land all the way through the chapter. Green's Literal, Darby, the New American Bible, the Young's Literal Translation, the International Standard Version. So that's a reasonable position to take. Now, Darby translates it as land, but in the Darby translation note, we read this, Eretz, earth. The prophecy begins with the land of Israel, and the scene enlarges, embracing the whole world, of which the land is the center. I love how these scholars like to hedge their bets when there's an option. However, most of the translations translate it as earth. The American Standard Version, Bible in Basic English, God's Word, NIV, Holman Christian Study Bible, KJV, the New Literal Translation, the Berean Study Bible, the New King James Version, the Amplified Bible, the Contemporary English Version, the English Revised Version, and the Good News Translation, all translated as earth. So does the ESV, but the ESV has it in a note, or land, also throughout this chapter. Naturally, if you're going to translate it one way, you're going to stick with it all the way through the chapter. More translations that translate Eretz as earth, the Peshitta Holy Bible translated, the Douay-Rheims Version, and the Scriptures ISR 1998, the Net Bible, the NET Bible, and the New Heart English Bible. So the majority go with earth. And I suspect as we go through here, we'll see a lot of futurist interpretations that Isaiah is referring to the end of the world. But I'm an Orthodox preterist, and I believe that Revelation refers to the end of Israel and all the way through the book of Revelation. Not all the way, but in most of the cases of gay, the Greek word equivalent to Eretz, I translate it as land, but most of the translations don't. They translate it as earth because most of them are futurist. So you see, one's theology is probably going to drive the translation here. There's no way to tell by context. It's difficult, at least. As you can see, some Bibles go one way, some Bibles go the other. As we go through here, I will try to give arguments one way or the other. I don't think there's enough clear evidence one way or the other from the context to show what Isaiah meant when he said Eretz, earth or land. Now, when is the Lord going to lay waste the earth or the land? Well, if it's the land, it could be the 10 tribes destroyed by Shalmaneser V and Sargon II in 722 BC, the 10 northern tribes, or it could be Nebuchadnezzar who destroyed the two southern tribes, Judah, in 586 BC. It could be the Romans who destroyed the rebuilt Israel in AD 70. It could refer to all of the above, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, and the Romans, 722, 586, and AD 70. But, of course, we shouldn't leave out the dispensationalist option by Guzik, the Great Tribulation, which I don't believe any more than I believe that I can fly to the moon that such a great tribulation exists in the future. We go now to verses 2 through 11 in Isaiah 24. It will be the same for priest as for people, for master as for servant, for mistress as for maid, for seller as for buyer, for borrower as for lender, for debtor as for creditor. The earth will be completely laid waste, or the land will be completely laid waste and totally plundered. The Lord has spoken this word. Now, different classes of society are mentioned, which is the typical Hebrew way of trying to say everybody, sort of poetic, sort of literary, high and low. Master, servant, mistress, maid, seller, and buyer is not really high or low, but two sides of the transaction, borrower and lender, so everything, everybody, going to be wiped out. Verse 3, the earth or the land will be completely laid waste and totally plundered. If it's the land, that means Israel is going to be completely laid waste. That, of course, happened in 722 under the Assyrians, Sargon II, and under the Babylonians in 586. Guzik, the dispensationalist, says that this is referring to the Great Tribulation in the future, and therefore we cannot take it literally that the land, that the earth will be completely laid waste and totally plundered, because the book of Revelation says only one-third of the people are destroyed. As you recall from the sealed judgments, that just shows how messed up hyper-literalist dispensationalist commentary can be. And not only messed up, but inconsistent. The hyper-literalist Guzik says that we need to take the completely laid waste in verse 3 as not literal, but we're going to take the seal judgments in Revelation as literal. That's inconsistent. He says that we can't take completely laid waste as literal because the seal judgments say that one-third were left. The earth will be completely laid waste, totally plundered, or the land. I suspect that's what happened when the Babylonians or the Assyrians came in and wiped Israel out. Verse 4, the land or the earth dries up and withers. The world languishes and withers. Now, if that's the world there, now if this is referring to the land drying up and withering, we then see a mention of the world languishing and withering. And so we might think, oh, this is talking about the earth, not just Israel, not just the land of Israel. But remember, the world to the Israelites was the ancient Near East. Moab, Ammon, Syria, Assyria, Babylon, Egypt. So land is still a perfectly reasonable translation there. The exalted of the land languish, or the exalted of the earth. Verse 5, the land is defiled by its people, by the Jews, or the earth. They have disobeyed the laws, violated the statutes, and broken the everlasting covenant. Now that sounds like the land of Israel disobeying laws and violating statutes, but you could say it's the laws written on the heart of every man, every Gentile. Laws of conscience, Romans 1. Now the land or the earth is said to have been populated by people who have broken the everlasting covenant. What is the everlasting covenant? Well, it could be the Abrahamic covenant. Benson affirms that. If so, then Eretz should be translated as land. The people of the land have broken the everlasting covenant. The land is defiled by its people. On the other hand, some people, some commentators like Ellicott, Cambridge, and Poole say that the everlasting covenant is the covenant of Noah. As we read in Genesis 9:16, the bow will be in the clouds, and I will look at it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and all the living creatures on earth. Everlasting covenant. So, in that case, Eretz should be translated as earth. So, you see, we don't really have the positive evidence one way or the other. Well, let's look real quickly at the options for everlasting covenant. It could be the covenant with Noah, as I just said. It could be the covenant of promise with Abraham, which is sealed by circumcision, as Benson says. It could be the old covenant at Mount Sinai, although John Gill denies that. It could be the new covenant, which John Gill says it is. Pulpit and Barnes says it's the natural law of the conscience written on every man, Romans 1. So, I report, you decide, I don't know. Verse 6, therefore a curse consumes the land, or the earth. Its people must bear their guilt. Therefore the earth's, or the land's, inhabitants are burned up, and very few are left. Well, you can see how this kind of rhetoric really makes the eschatological aficionados very happy. This sounds like disaster over the whole world. The killiest would love that kind of translation. However, there have been several instances when the land's inhabitants were burned up. Babylon in 586 B.C., for example, 70 A.D. by the Romans. Very few are left. The new wine dries up and the vine withers. All the merrymakers groan. Stamping out grapes at the time of the vintage, of course, was a very happy time. And if these merrymakers who are stomping on the grapes, if they're groaning, that means things are really bad. Verse 8, the gaiety of the tambourines is still. The noise of the revelers has stopped. The joyful harp is silent. No longer do they drink wine with a song. The beer is bitter to its drinkers. The ruined city lies desolate. Now, what city that is, I suspect is Jerusalem, because I favor the land translation, but it could be just a ruined city in general. The entrance to every house is barred. That's to keep invaders out. In the streets, they cry out for wine. All joy turns to gloom. All gaiety is banished from the land or the earth. You see, that simple translation issue makes a big difference in how you interpret this chapter. If you're talking about a worldwide conflagration where everybody is wiped out, that's gloom and doom on steroids. But if you say land, well, it refers to what's going to happen in Isaiah's time or within a century or two of Isaiah. And things are a little bit more optimistic. We go now to Isaiah 24, verses 12 through 16. The city is left in ruins. Its gate is battered to pieces. So will it be on the earth and among the nations as when an olive tree is beaten or as when gleanings are left after the grape harvest. Now, if you take this as the land of Israel getting wiped out, of course, there were a few left behind, as we know in the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah actually went with the rump down to Egypt. So there were a few left. Verse 13, so will it be on the land and among the nations? Well, among the nations, that sounds like the whole earth, not just the land of Israel, unless you take the gleanings to be symbolic of the remnant of the people of the world who do believe in God and believe in Jesus in the new covenant. So it's either this remnant, these couple of olives that are left after the olive tree is beaten, or the few grapes that are left after the vineyard is gleaned. These few olives, these few grapes, these few believers, or these few people could either refer to believers in the new covenant, or it could refer to physical people in Jerusalem, the few of them that are left after the disaster falls on the land, 586 BC, most probably. Verse 14, they raise their voices. Now, let me give you some options as to who the they are. Ellicott says it's the remnant of the saved, both Jew and Gentile, the ones who were like the olives left at the top of the tree. What harvesters would do, they'd beat an olive tree with a rod to get the olives down, but usually there were a few left at the top branches that were too hard to get to. So basically you're talking about a remnant of the olives are left in the tree, and so the symbolism there is there's a remnant of believers who are left behind. Now whether those are actual physical people in Jerusalem, not believers, but physical people, or whether they're actually believers in Yahweh that are left behind, or carrying it over into the New Testament, believers in Jesus. John Gill believes that. The elect, the remnant according to election. We're talking about a remnant here. So verse 14, they raise their voices. Ellicott says that's who's being referred to. The remnant is the one. The remnant contains the people who are raising their voices. Barnes says it's those who are not carried off to Babylon. That's the other option, as I just said. And Colin Delitzsch says it's the remnant of the church. Not talking about believing Jews in the Old Covenant who are left behind after the judgment, but the church in the New Covenant. I tend to go along with Barnes on this. I think it's referring to those who weren't carried off to Babylon. But I report it, you decide, because it's really hard to be dogmatic about this. They raise their voices, verse 14, they shout for joy. From the west they acclaim the Lord's majesty. Therefore, in the east, give glory to the Lord, exalt the name of the Lord, the God of Israel, and the islands of the sea. Now, islands of the sea is a common expression in the Old Testament. The sea is the Mediterranean, most probably. There are lots of islands in the Mediterranean. Look at the Ionian Islands off the coast of Turkey, and then go further toward Greece. You've got the Aegean Islands, and then the Tyrrhenian Sea. There's Sardinia and Corsica. And then, of course, back over toward the east, going toward the land of Israel, you've got Crete and Cyprus. There's islands everywhere. The Balearic Islands off the coast of Spain, the Mediterranean coast of Spain. So basically, Isaiah is talking about the whole known area of his time, which is the Mediterranean Sea and all the islands thereof. Sometimes it's coastlands of the sea, which means it would be the coast of the Mediterranean. But whatever it is, the point of it all is that God is going to be given honor everywhere. Now, Adam Clark says that the islands of the sea refer not only to islands in the Mediterranean Sea, but to any distant nation that might be anywhere, including the islands in the Mediterranean Sea. Colin Dillich just says the sea is the Mediterranean Sea and the islands are literally those that are in the Mediterranean Sea. And that's the way I take it. Now, that is an argument that cuts in favor of Eretz being the earth, because we're talking about things that are happening outside of the land of Israel. And in verse 16, we see from the ends of the earth, we hear singing. That sounds like the whole world, the whole earth. It could refer typologically to the worldwide spread of the gospel. People are singing with joy because the knowledge of Yahweh is spread all over the world. Now, the singing that is heard all the way to the ends of the earth or the ends of the land. Glory to the righteous one. Now, the NIV has righteous one, but there's a translation issue here. In fact, Ellicott denies that this refers to God. That's the first logical option. Righteous one. Glory to the righteous one. Well, that's Yahweh. Ellicott denies it. He says that there are two reasons for that. The word translated glory here is a word that is not commonly used in doxologies of praise to Yahweh, glory to Yahweh. It's a different Hebrew word, he says. And he also says that righteous one is never used absolutely as a name of God. So, well, what else can it be? Well, the other option on how to translate righteous one is righteous people. Honor to the true Israel of God as a righteous people. That would be to the remnant who believe, or whether to the physical remnant who survived the Babylonian captivity, however you want to take it. Glory to the righteous people. Well, that translation is preferred by Joseph Benson, by the pulpit commentary, by Ellicott, by Colin Dillich, and by Cambridge. Or Benson and pulpit just mention it, but Ellicott, Colin Dillich, and Cambridge actually affirm and say that's what it means. Now, I looked up some translations to see if I could find some to back that up, and I did. Here's the American Standard Version of Isaiah 24:16. From the uttermost part of the earth have we heard songs, glory to the righteous. Isaiah 24:16, Bible in Basic English. From the farthest part of the earth comes the sound of songs, glory to the upright. KJV has, from the uttermost part of the earth have we heard songs, even glory to the righteous. Young's literal translation, from the skirt of the earth we heard songs, the desire of the righteous. So the remnant, the righteous remnant, is either singing glory to Yahweh or glory to the remnant, the righteous people who love Yahweh. Well, from that high note, Isaiah ends verse 16 by saying, but I said, I waste away, woe to me, the treacherous betray. Who are the treacherous? Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say this word refers to the foreign nations that oppress Jerusalem and overcome it by stratagem. The pulpit commentator says it's the ungodly of the earth. Well, whether it's ungodly nations or ungodly people, Isaiah knows they're bad guys out there, always fighting against the glory of the Lord spreading all over the land or the earth. We go down to Isaiah 24, verses 17 through 20. Isaiah continues, terror and pit and snare await you, O people of the earth, or O people of the land. Whoever flees at the sound of terror will fall into a pit. Whoever climbs out of the pit will be caught in a snare. Going from the frying pan to the fire is how we would say that. The floodgates of the heavens are open, the foundations of the earth shake. The earth is broken up, or the land is broken up. The earth is split asunder, or the land is split asunder. The earth is thoroughly shaken, or the land is thoroughly shaken. The earth or the land reels like a drunkard. It sways like a hut in the wind. So heavy upon it is the guilt of its rebellion that it falls, never to rise again. So we see that Isaiah once more is using his rhetorical ability to describe judgment, destruction, gloom, and doom. In verse 17, he says the floodgates of the heavens are opened. That is a reference to Noah's flood. And then after that, we have what the theologian David Chilton says is decreation rhetoric, when things of nature go kerflooey and are destroyed or act unnaturally. Decreation rhetoric is not meant to be taken literally. It is meant to indicate the destruction of political power. So in verse 18, when verse 18 says the floodgates of the heavens are opened, this is not referring to a rainstorm. The foundations of the earth shake, that's not referring to a literal earthquake. It's symbolic, apocalyptic language for the land of Israel is going down, or the geopolitical nations of the earth are going down, depending on how you want to translate Eretz. Shake, of course, is referring to an earthquake. And naturally, the dispensationalist Guzik puts it in the Great Tribulation, the so-called Great Tribulation at the end of the world, which doesn't exist in my humble opinion. Dispensationalists amaze me how they can read stuff that's as unclear as this and say, see there, it's the Great Tribulation. And everybody follows them like a pack of geese without doing any independent study. Now in verse 20, the earth reels like a drunkard. It sways like a hut in the wind. Again, decreation rhetoric. So heavy upon it is the guilt of its rebellion that it falls. Whether it's the land of Israel, there's plenty of rebellion there, or whether it's the whole earth, lots of rebellion. Now, the earth or the land is said here at the end of verse 20, never to rise again. Well, that's a problem. If it's the earth that's literally wiped out, I say it's a problem. It's a problem for hyperliteralists. It's a problem for dispensationalists. It's not a problem for me because I take it all symbolically. But if you're going to say that the physical earth is never going to rise again, well, now, most people think there's going to be a new earth that will be constituted physically after its bondage to decay is ended, as in Romans 8. I don't like to use the phrase new heavens and new earth because I think that refers to the new covenant, but I do believe there's going to be a physical earth that we're going to live on when it's all over. So if you take Eretz to be earth and you read at the end of verse 20 that the earth is never to rise again, you've got a problem. How to solve it? Option number one is to say the old earth is never to rise again, but there'll be a new earth when it's remade physically. A second way to solve it is by what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says. He says, in those convulsions, it would not rise again. In other words, while it's reeling around like a drunkard and swaying like a hut in the wind, it's going to fall from that, and it's not going to rise again at that time. But later on, it will be. So I don't guess the hyperliteral futurist and millennialist and killiest, I don't think that's really too much of a problem for them. They can get around that. But now note something here in verse 20. If Eretz is land, and we say the land is ... never to rise again, whoa, that's sort of hard on dispensationalists. It would mean that geopolitical Israel would never rise again, and we know what they think about that. We go now to verses 21 through 23, and we will finish Isaiah 24. Isaiah continues, in that day the Lord will punish the powers in the heavens above and the kings on the earth below. They will be herded together like prisoners bound in a dungeon. They will be shut up in prison and be punished after many days. The moon will be abashed, the sun ashamed, for the Lord Almighty will reign on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem and before its elders gloriously. In that day, Isaiah says in verse 21, when is that? First option, final judgment at the end of the world. Colin Delitzsch and the pulpit commentary hold to that. Second option, at the Babylonian captivity in 586, Barnes holds to that. I tend to hold to that, too, because I like Eretz's land, but I'm not going to stand on a hill and defend that. That's just a tendency I have. Option number three, this is, according to Matthew Poole, day is an indefinite time, a time known only to God. That's kind of punning a little bit. In that day, the Lord will punish the powers in the heavens above. What are the powers in the heavens above? Here's some options. Option number one, the heavenly bodies. Again, that's decreation rhetoric. Like the stars will fall from the sky like fig trees from the fig tree and other places. It could be angels that God's going to punish. Why would he do that? I don't know. It could be Satan and his demons. Well, that makes a little more sense. Remember that phrase, principalities and powers that Paul uses in the New Testament? Isaac Newton, the same Isaac Newton who invented the law of gravity, or discover the law of gravity. He says that the powers here are symbolic for earthly rulers. In that day, the Lord will punish the powers in the heavens, the earthly rulers. I think that's a little bit too symbolic for me. I think it's the stars, the heavenly bodies, decreation rhetoric, which symbolizes the end of geopolitical power. And God, in verse 21, is going to punish the kings on the earth below. So the stars in heaven and the planets in heaven get zapped, metaphorically, of course, and then the kings on the earth below will get zapped physically, not symbolically. And of course, it could be kings on the land below. Now, if you say earth for Eretz, in favor of that is the fact that the focus is now on punishing all the kings who have persecuted Israel. The kings of the earth in verse 22 will be herded together in a dungeon because they persecuted Israel. Now, of course, the earth might not mean the whole globe, like China, New Zealand, but referring to the whole world as known to Isaiah, which is the ancient Near East, Moab, Ammon, Assyria, Syria, Babylon and Egypt, Libya, Put, Ethiopia. Now, to make an argument that Eretz in verse 21 should be land, so that it would read, God will punish the kings on the land below. Verse 22, they will be herded together like prisoners bound in a dungeon. If all of these rulers that have been coming after Israel, like all the nations that were allied with Babylon, coming in 586, they're going to be herded together like prisoners in the land, in Israel. So, we have a problem as to when all these kings of the earth would be put in a dungeon. We'll get to that in just a minute. First of all, verse 22 says, they, the kings of the earth or the kings of the land, will be herded together. Now, John Gill, of all people, says this is a reference to Armageddon. So he takes a very futuristic view. I assume he takes Eretz to be earth. They will be herded together like prisoners bound in a dungeon. Here's what Clark says about the dungeon. Taken from the practice of the great monarchs of that time, who, when they had thrown their wretched captives into a dungeon, never gave themselves the trouble of inquiring about them, but let them lie a long time in that miserable condition, wholly destitute of relief and disregarded, God shall at length revisit and restore his people in the last age, and then the kingdom of God shall be established in such perfection as wholly to obscure and eclipse the glory of the temporary, typical, preparative kingdom now subsisting. Well, Clark says that basically throwing the great monarchs of the age in the prison is symbolic of the destruction of all geopolitical power in preparation for the triumph of the spiritual kingdom of Jesus. So I just think this is a symbolic expression for the fact that the geopolitical powers on earth are going to be punished in preparation for the New Jerusalem, the church, to be established in the New Covenant era. Now, the fact that these kings of the earth are shut up in prison and are to be punished after many days, John Gill says after many days, after the millennium, the devil and his angels are bound in hell. I think that is an extreme stretch. Maybe Gill is pre-mill. I don't know. And he believes in a thousand-year future millennium. Well, even if he doesn't, even if he is all-mill or post-mill, we've got the whole length of the church age. And then finally, after many days, the church age will be over. And at that time, at the same time that Jesus comes back, the evil rulers of the earth will be judged, cast into hell at the great white throne judgment. I don't think so. I think that this is just a reference to the practice of throwing kings in jail and leaving them there for a long time without inquiring about them. Verse 23, we see the moon will be abashed. That means its light will be dimmed, the sun ashamed, same idea. Its sun will be dimmed. Again, that's decreation rhetoric. It doesn't mean that the moon will actually start being dimmer or the sun being dimmer, because there's going to be regime change, a change in covenants. We're going to go from the old to the new. Now, whether that's referring to the destruction of Babylon, as I've been sort of contending as we've gone through here, or AD 70 when the Romans destroyed the Old Testament system, the rabbinic system, not the Old Testament system of Israel, that's signified by decreation rhetoric, the moon being abashed and the sun ashamed. In fact, in the Olivet Discourse, which referred to the exact same thing, in my humble Orthodox preterist opinion, we had the same type of rhetoric. The moon turns red and the sun turns black at noon and so forth. And at that time of regime change, signified by the decreation rhetoric, we see that the Lord Almighty will reign on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem. Now, that could be, of course, the destruction of Israel by the Babylonians, and then afterwards, after the exile, after the return, God will reign on Mount Zion in the second temple, Mount Zion being taken there literally, and God will reign in Jerusalem literally and before its elders, the elders of Jerusalem, gloriously. Could be. That could be a type of, or maybe Isaiah is directly referring to, the destruction of the rabbinic system in AD 70, when the Lord will reign in the church. Now, it doesn't say the church, it says Mount Zion, but we know in Hebrews 12:22 that Mount Zion refers to the church. Hebrews 12:22, instead, you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to myriads of angels in festive gathering. That obviously is the church of Jesus Christ. So I think it's very reasonable here to say that Isaiah is predicting their arrival of the Christian church. And even if you take, as Barnes does, the previous verses to refer to the destruction of Israel in 586. That is a perfect type of the destruction of Israel in AD 70 and the establishment of the kingdom of Christ and the church. After 586, the Jews came back and they set up a temple again. After AD 70, the Christians set up a new temple, the temple of the church. Now, as I said, the moon being abashed and the sun ashamed, decreation rhetoric is not meant to be taken literally. Here's an example of how the kingdom of heaven has Christ as its light. Light is not to be taken literally. The light of the moon and the light of the sun getting dark is not literal. Likewise, the light in the kingdom of heaven is not literal. In Revelation 21, 23 through 24, we read this. The city, that's the New Jerusalem, symbolic of the church. The city does not need the sun or the moon to shine on it, because God's glory illuminates it, and its lamp is the Lamb. The nations will walk in its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it. That's talking about the spiritual light of the kingdom of God. That's not talking about physical sunlight or moonlight. Now, I'm going to quote somebody to back me up on all this, and it's Sir Isaac Newton. Now, Sir Isaac Newton is sort of famous. He discovered the law of gravity. How he did it, I don't know. He wrote Principia Mathematica, a book that revolutionized mathematics. He co-invented calculus, or actually invented calculus at the same time that Leibniz did. He was a Christian, too. I think he was an Arian, unfortunately. But he was a Christian, and he's one smart guy. Here's what he says. For the heavens and the things therein signify thrones and dignities. I don't think so. I think he's wrong there. I think he refers to stars and planets. And those who enjoy these thrones and dignities, and the earth with the inferior people. So the peoples of the earth are the kings. I think he's right about that, are kings. And the lowest parts of the earth, called Hades or hell, the lowest or most miserable part of the people on earth. Well, that refers to other places in the scripture where Hades is called the lowest parts of the earth. That's a debate that people go into when they try to describe Hades. Remember, Christ ascended, then he descended into the lowest parts of the earth, as is quoted in Ephesians. And the question is, does that mean he descended into the inferior regions of the planet earth, but still on the surface of the earth, or whether he descended out down on into Hades? That's a debate. And actually, I don't really care about that. I wish I hadn't quoted that. But now we start with Isaac Newton. Great earthquakes and the shaking of heaven and earth are put for the shaking of kingdoms so as to distract and overthrow them. The creating a new heaven and earth and the passing away of an old one, or the beginning and end of a world, for the rise and ruin of a body politic, signified thereby regime change. The sun stands for the whole species and race of kings and the kingdoms of the world. Politic, the moon, for the body of the common people. Well, he might be going a little too far there, but he says it's not literal. The moon is considered as the king's wife. The stars for subordinate princes and great men, or for the bishops and rulers of the people of God. When the sun is Christ, the setting of the sun, moon, and stars, darkening the sun, turning the moon into blood, and falling of the stars, for the ceasing of a kingdom. For the ceasing of a kingdom, regime change. I love to have Isaac Newton on my side. Ladies and gentlemen, on that happy note, we're finished with Isaiah chapter 24, and we are ready to turn in our next audio to Isaiah chapter 25, which I will call God Will Swallow Up Death Forever. That sounds pretty optimistic. I hope to see you in the next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.